Hello, everybody, and welcome to this week's edition of the Wallingford District Talking Newspaper. We're reading articles from the Wallingford Herald, published on Wednesday, February the 11th, 2026. We'll also include, at the end of the paper, some articles from the monthly magazines, and we've also got a two-week look-ahead from the events calendar. The three readers this evening are Jill Farrow, Louise Smith and Jill Davies. The copier is Pete Orton and the producer is myself, Lawrence.
Hello, this is Jill. Months-long closures of A34 to begin. The A34 around Oxford and Abingdon will see a series of road closures until the end of the month. National Highways will be carrying out resurfacing work along the dual carriageway, fixing the potholes frustrating motorists. It will be closed in both directions between the Marcham interchange at Abingdon up to the Botley interchange in Oxford. Starting from 9 p.m. tonight, the road closures will be every night until February the 28th. The A34 will reopen each morning at 6 a.m. National Highways has been approached for a comment. Meanwhile, work continues on the new A34 Lodge Hill entry and exit slip roads at Abingdon North.
Hello, I'm Louise. Thug jailed for unprovoked attack near railway station. A young thug has been jailed for 3 years after an unprovoked attack near a train station left his victim with a broken jaw and chipped teeth. Caleb Law of Goldsmiths Lane, Wallingford, was sentenced at Oxford Crown Court on Thursday, February the 5th. The 20-year-old pleaded guilty to causing grievous bodily harm with intent to Jaden Hennessy at the Broadway in Didcot on November the 29th last year. He also pleaded guilty to driving while disqualified the next day. The court heard that Law committed the offences in breach of a suspended sentence he received in March 2024 for dangerous driving. Matt Knight, prosecuting, told the court Mr. Hennessy was walking home from Didcot Parkway station at around 2 a.m. and passed a parked car Law was sitting in. Law approached Mr. Hennessy and punched him 3 times, including once on the ground. He then got back into his car, the court heard. Mr. Knight said, there was no rhyme or reason. It was completely unprovoked. Mr. Hennessy had a double jaw fracture. The court was shown CCTV footage of the attack. Mr. Hennessy could be seen walking past the car with Law getting out. Law then appeared to speak to Mr. Hennessy before confronting and punching him to the ground. Mr. Knight said that it was a case of mistaken identity as Law thought it was someone else who had stolen his bike. The court heard that Mr. Hennessy had jaw fractures and a chipped tooth. He had an operation to fix his jaw and had to have 2 teeth removed. Mr. Knight added, "It's clear they did not know each other." In mitigation, the court heard that Law described the incident as a very poor decision. It was also heard that Law had expressed remorse for his actions and that he had previously refused to take medication for ADHD due to the side effects. Judge Hassan Khan said, "On November the 29th in Didcot, Mr. Hennessy was walking past your car and it seems you exited and punched him in the face. It was all captured on CCTV. He had jaw fractures and a chipped tooth. The following day, you were seen driving a car. You were disqualified in 2024. There was an element of revenge, albeit a case of mistaken identity. You fully admitted the offences and you thought the victim was someone you knew, but that was not the case. It was impulsive. It's far too serious for me to be able to suspend the sentence. Law was jailed for 3 years and banned from driving for 3 years.
Hello, this is the other Jill. Arrests made during police campaign. Hundreds of arrests have been made as part of a major police campaign targeting street crime. Thames Valley Police announced the results following the Winter of Action, a 2-month programme launched on December 1st to tackle crime and antisocial behaviour in town and city centres across the region. The operation focused on retail crime, street crime, and safety in the nighttime economy, with particular emphasis on violence against women and girls. Officers made a total of 266 arrests for offences, including shoplifting, robbery, and theft from a person. Thames Valley Police also recorded 87 positive outcomes for retail crime and 23 for antisocial behaviour, using a mix of charges, out-of-court disposals, and community resolutions. More than 5,700 hotspot patrols were carried out. These included high visibility reassurance policing, antisocial behaviour patrols, and targeted e-scooter operations. In addition to enforcement activity, officers completed 2,757 community and business engagements to provide crime prevention advice and support to victims and retailers. A TVP spokesman said, "While the winter of action has now concluded, Thames Valley Police is committed to protecting town and city centres and delivering effective, community-focused policing continues."
Blues and Jazz Festival is back. A hugely popular blues and jazz festival is set to return to Wallingford this month, with free acts as well as ticketed events hosting world-class talents in venues around the town. Wallingford Winter Blues and Jazz Festival was hailed a raging success for its second incarnation last year and is set to return for the weekend for the third time. This year will be even bigger as a new venue is joining the lineup to host musicians, the ballroom of the George Hotel. Acts include Ma Bessie, aka Julia Titus, Bossa Gringo and Art Thiemann. Math Potts, who organises the event with a group of hard-working jazz enthusiasts and volunteers, mostly from Cromarsh group Crow Jazz, said he's excited for this year's event. "We're going even bigger this year and having a bit of fun," he said. And the article is accompanied by a photograph of Ma Bessie in a rather interesting and colourful outfit.
Potholes forcing drivers to slalom like Winter Olympics. Drivers in Didcot and surrounding villages have been complaining about potholes damaging their vehicles and costing them hundreds of pounds in repairs. A growing number of large potholes have been appearing on the roads, with some impossible to avoid. The situation has got so bad that Didcot West County Councillor Ian Snowden has now started to tour the town to paint lines around the largest potholes. Tesco lorry driver Julian Pudner is among those who have complained about the poor state of the roads after a car driven by his wife hit a large pothole. The incident happened on Tuesday last week when Mr. Pudner's wife Sarah was driving their Citroen C1 on the B4493 approach to Didcot, close to the Mendip Heights roundabout. After the car tyre hit the pothole at the side of the road, the couple who live in the Lady Grove estate were left with a garage bill of £165 to cover the cost of replacing the damaged wheel and damaged tyre. Mr. Pudner said the County Council's claims form requested details of the car's mileage when the puncture took place. He added, "The state of our roads in Oxfordshire is beyond belief. You spend more time swerving than actually driving straight. The B4493 approach to Didcot from the A34 is just one of virtually all roads in and around Didcot which has a pothole. The one in question measures about 2 foot long and about 8 inches deep. It is very difficult to avoid." Didcot West County Councillor Ian Snowden said, "The potholes on the roads around Didcot are horrendous at the moment. Some of them are like craters. The High Street in Long Whitnam is in a terrible state. It's like the Winter Olympics for drivers. They have to slalom their way through to miss the potholes." It's a horrendous situation at the moment. Lots of potholes have been appearing and some of them are huge. They're like craters. I've had some training, so I've been going round and marking up potholes so drivers can see them. Traffic cones have been placed next to some of the bigger potholes, but that's not ideal because they can get moved. The recent cold snap led to a rise in reports of potholes, with Oxfordshire County Council increasing its repair crews to help reduce the backlog. In January, 35% of repairs to larger potholes, which the council aims to complete in 28 days, missed the deadline by a few days. The county council said this was due to the increase in reports and that crews had faced many larger potholes. The county council previously said that 97% of Oxfordshire's pothole repairs are now cut square, joint sealed, filled and compacted to undertake a permanent fix first time.
Warehouse worker 23, who died in tragic incident named at inquest. A warehouse worker who died in a tragic accident at work after a collision between industrial vehicles has been named at an inquest opening. The worker has been named as Kasper Zulch, a 23-year-old man who was born in Poland and lived in Wallingford. Mr. Zulch worked as a warehouse operative at Hachette UK Distribution Centre in Milton Road between Milton and Didcot and was involved in a workplace incident when he died on Tuesday, January the 20th. An inquest into how, when, where and why Mr. Zulch died was opened by Area Coroner Nicholas Graham at Oxfordshire Coroner's Court. The inquest opening said, Mr. Zulch was involved in a collision between two industrial vehicles on January the 20th, 2026 at a warehouse in Didcot. Sadly, his injuries were deemed unsurvivable at the scene and death was verified the same day. A police investigation is ongoing into the circumstances of Mr. Zulch's death. A post-mortem examination has been carried out with final cause of death pending further analysis. Mr. Zulch's family identified him to a police officer at the John Radcliffe Hospital mortuary 10 days after his death on January the 30th. No date has yet been sent for the full inquest to be heard pending a police investigation. Emergency services were called to the trading estate between Milton and Didcot on January the 20th, and the following day, Thames Valley Police released a statement that another man had been arrested in connection with the incident. A 21-year-old man from Wallingford was arrested on suspicion of gross negligence manslaughter and was subsequently bailed. The police's statement in full, released on Wednesday, January the 21st, said, "We received a report of an industrial accident at an address on Milton Road, Didcot, at around 9:45 a.m. on Tuesday, January the 20th. Sadly, a 23-year-old man has died. His next of kin have been informed and offered support by officers. A 21-year-old man from Wallingford was arrested on suspicion of gross negligence manslaughter and has since been bailed." Meanwhile, Hachette's UK spokeswoman offered condolences to the family and said the company is working with the police. A spokesperson from Hachette said, "There was a tragic incident at Hachette UK's distribution warehouse that heartbreakingly led to the loss of a much loved colleague. The incident is under police investigation. We are fully cooperating and working with the emergency service. We are doing everything we can to support the family, our staff and all those impacted."
Patriotism or intimidation? Opinion split on flags in town. People in Wallingford are divided over the hanging of England and Union flags in roads around the town. Ben Cullen, the principal player of Raise the Colours Oxfordshire, the local branch of National Campaign, which has seen flags raised on lampposts and street signs across the county, lives in Wallingford with his partner Trudy. The pair have been organising supporters for months to hang flags on public roads and residential streets across the town and received mixed reactions from locals. But Mr. Cullen and Trudy, who did not want to share their surname, said their goal is to unite the community, not divide it, and they're hanging flags to protest the government's stance on illegal immigration. Trudy said, "We're trying to bring the community together and get them talking, mainly about the government and how we disagree with a lot of their policies on how they allow illegal immigrants into the country with no paperwork, and they're putting them up here. Then we've got families in poverty in this country, we've got veterans living on the streets, there are so many problems this country needs to deal with their own people first." She added that legal immigration is fine and they're here to help for people who prove they're genuinely needy leading it, she said. "It's not a racist thing." However, people in Wallingford who have spoken to this newspaper said that's not the way the flags are coming across. One woman who wanted to remain anonymous for their safety said, "I literally have no issue with the flag. It is how they use it to thinly veil their hate, racism and intimidation that I disagree with." She said that people on her street came together after one incident and removed the flags themselves, but were filmed by supporters of Raise the Colours and posted on social media who were threatening and intimidating. Another woman who lives in Wallingford said, "They pretend their message is one of patriotism when it is nothing of the sort. Our beautiful town has been littered with their far-right message in the image of our national flag, and this is angering a lot of Wallingfordians. We are virtually powerless to take them down because their whole attitude is to instill fear. Nobody dares to stick their head above the parapet for fear of being intimidated, and that goes for the powers that be." After flags were put up overnight in Castle Street, householders collectively lobbied the council to have them removed. An anonymous man from Northern Ireland who has lived in the street for decades said, "My neighbours, quintessentially British and traditional, were even more angry than I was. They said it was racist. To describe your own flag as racist is quite fascinating, really. It shows what happens when you misuse and mispresent a flag. This isn't patriotism, it's an abuse of a national symbol which has been weaponised." But Mr. Cullen contended, "The majority of people in Wallingford come up to us in the street, people we've never met before, shaking our hands and thanking us. They send us messages, they send us money for more flags. We've got businesses in Wallingford who are helping us." His partner Trudy added, "It's not a racist thing. Why would seeing your own flag flying make you fear something? The end goal is to try and get a government in what will, to try and get a government in that will listen to us and to listen to the illegal immigration status and start doing something about it." Mr. Cullen and Trudy said they're happy to discuss everything and explain their actions to anyone who asks, and they're not secretive about who they are or what they're doing. Mr. Cullen was one of the attendees at an event from Charity Camarados, run by Math Potts, called Grub and Gripe, and held in November, in which people from both sides of the debate sat down over a free bowl of chilli to discuss their differing opinions. Mr. Potts said, "We did it because there was a huge amount of vitriol on local Facebook pages, really horrible language from all sides, and we thought we'd try a grub and gripe in Wallingford to bring back the idea that you can disagree well and still have a cup of tea together and still talk. Trying to get people from all sides of the debate together was difficult. Lots of people were dropping out or too nervous to come right up to the last minute, and it was really tense to start with. But sure enough, when the food came and people started talking, there was a lot of ice thawing. The main goal of the night was for people to disagree without trying to persuade, to encourage healthy debate, but locals in the town still say they are afraid, while protagonists of the Raise the Colours movement maintain they're trying to unite the community." And the article is accompanied by a picture of Ben Cullen holding out a Unite the Kingdom flag.
Fears over growing pothole fiasco despite record funds. Esme Kenny on growing concerns over the county's worsening potholes. Concerns have been raised over the fiasco of the county's pothole-studded roads, despite the government providing Oxfordshire with a record £168 million up to 2030 to fix the problem. The recent cold snap has led to a rise in reports of potholes, with Oxfordshire County Council increasing its repair crews to help reduce its backlog. Utility companies have been blamed for failing to fix the roads after doing work. In January, 35% of repairs to larger potholes, which the council says it aims to complete in 28 days, missed the deadline by a few days. The council said this was due to the rise in reports and because crews had been faced with many larger potholes. Liam Walker, leader of the Conservative opposition group, said, "Extra funding is always welcome, but money alone won't fix Oxfordshire's potholes if repairs simply keep failing. Residents are rightly frustrated when one pothole is fixed but another just feet away is left because it isn't on the worksheet. That looks disorganised and shows there isn't a clear plan in place to better coordinate repairs." Mr. Walker added, "We cannot accept backlogs building up during peak months or poor contract management that leaves too few crews out on the roads. Contractors must get repairs right the first time, as the fiasco of this winter with a 35% backlog for repairs was completely unacceptable, and someone should be fired, in my view, for this utter incompetence." Labour County Councillor James Fry, the Shadow Cabinet Member for Transport Management, said, "Right now, potholes have overtaken congestion charging as the main issue raised by local residents, especially cyclists. It is no surprise that there is great annoyance over the time taken to repair some of the potholes on busy routes. The complaints extend beyond potholes as defined by the county, which are holes of over 4 centimetres in depth. Long sections of broken road surfaces and shallow trenches surrounded by gravel after it rains are just as annoying." He said many of the problems with road surfaces were down to utility companies and their contractors failing to resurface the road properly after finishing utility works, and the County Council should do more to combat this. "It would not take many examples of action to enforce contractual requirements for the contractors to realise that they will be out of pocket if they fail to give road users back a surface in the proper condition." The county was also ranked amber for its pothole performance, which is based on road conditions and how it spends money from the government in the Department for Transport's traffic light system. MPs Annalise Dodds, Sean Woodcock and leader of the County Council's Labour group, Liz Brighouse, wrote to Lib Dem Transport Chief Andrew Gant, expressing their disappointment about Oxfordshire's rating. But Lib Dem Cabinet Member for Transport Management, Andrew Gant, argued the real cause of the issue was the lack of funding for local government in his response to the MP's letter. Fellow Lib Dem Councillor Tim Bearder added, "I think to fully understand the pothole problem, you have to look at the wider crisis of funding the council is currently facing. The government is planning to cut funding to Oxfordshire County Council by £24.1 million over the next 3 years. That's equivalent to the cost of running the entire library service across the county or the entire expenditure of the Vale of Wight Horse District Council for 1 year. The potholes are bad, not because of any neglect on behalf of successive councils, but because for decades national governments have systematically underfunded local government, forcing us to make impossible choices between roads and social care or libraries or children's centres." Mr. Fry added, "Given the large backlog of road repairs, including dealing with potholes, there is no way in which any realistic level of added investment will be sufficient to resolve the problem quickly. The issue is how the money is spent most effectively. I know that the contractor has been asked to increase the intensity of its work on pothole repairs, but I would like to be assured that they are no longer doing short-term fixes, which will have to be repeated soon. Anecdotal evidence is that in the medium term, quicker and cheap patching is a false economy. Therefore, priority should be given to lasting repairs, even if this means that fewer potholes can be repaired in a short period. The County Council previously said that 97% of Oxfordshire's pothole repairs are now cut square, joint sealed filled and compacted to undertake a permanent fix first time. They added, while reactive highway work is vital, particularly for potholes that cause an immediate danger, the Council's emphasis is on maintenance work to prevent potholes forming in the first place, which is much more cost effective than repairing them afterwards. More than 41,000 highways defects were reported to the County Council in the last 12 months, around 90% of which were potholes. It has also invested nearly £14.5 million since 2024 on its largest surface dressing programmes for at least 20 years, treating around 2 million square metres of carriageway.
RSPCA wants residents' views on dog licensing. People in Oxfordshire are being encouraged to take part in a new public survey that asks for views on the possible reintroduction of dog licensing in the UK. The research is being led by the RSPCA, Dogs Trust, and the York Health Economics Consortium to explore how dog ownership could be made safer and better supported, with a particular focus on public attitudes towards dog licensing. Dr. Samantha Gaines, dog welfare expert at the RSPCA, said, "We want to hear from as many people as possible to help improve responsible dog ownership and to ensure dog owners, as well as those who come into contact with dogs, are supported. This study will explore approaches such as dog licensing, so feedback from the public is essential for helping to ensure that any future policies reflect the needs of dog owners and the wider community." Dog licensing was abolished in Great Britain in 1987, but the practice remains in place in Northern Ireland and other countries. The study is inviting input from both dog owners and non-owners. Alex Finlow, Public Affairs Manager at Dogs Trust, said, "By sharing your views with us, you can help shape the future of dog ownership and the measures that could contribute to better welfare and safer communities." And the survey can be accessed at rspca.org.uk/advice-and-welfare/pets/dogs.
Play areas receive funding boost. Play areas, community centres and sustainability projects have received a funding boost. In South Oxfordshire, £320,000 has been awarded through the South Oxfordshire District Council's Capital Grant Scheme to support community projects that improve quality of life for residents. The Berrin Centre in Berrinsfield will receive £75,000 to improve accessibility and sustainability. Laura Hart, director of the Berrin Centre, said, "The support provided by the South Oxfordshire District Council Capital Grant Scheme has made our project possible. The refurbishment of the Berrin Centre will enable us to support more people and make sure that this well-loved community facility continues to feel like the warm and welcoming space that it's known to be. The planned improvements include upgrading the heating system, adding insulation, resealing windows, installing new doors and replacing and widening the access ramps. A new kitchen will also be installed, and redecoration throughout the centre will help create a more welcoming environment. Wheatley Parish Council has been awarded £50,000 to refurbish the playground at Church Road Recreation Ground." Alison Sercombe, Chairman of Wheatley Parish Council, said, "Wheatley's Church Road Recreation Ground was last refurbished in 2007 and is showing signs of wear and tear from generations of Wheatley children. This is an exciting project which will deliver both physical and imaginative play for the next generation of children, family members and carers, and will be an asset to the village. The South Oxfordshire District Council Capital Grant Scheme supports voluntary organisations and parish councils with projects that benefit the community. Councillor Georgina Heritage, Cabinet Member for Committees at South Oxfordshire District Council, said, "We are delighted to be able to award Capital Grant Scheme funding to help local organisations, our local voluntary sector and town and parish councils bring impactful projects to life that will benefit communities and improve quality for life for people in South Oxfordshire. A total of 10 projects have been funded in the 2025-26 round. These include installing new bicycle shelters with e-bike charging at the Earth Trust Centre, installing solar panels on the roof of Holton Village Hall, new changing rooms at Abingdon Rugby Club, converting the Forge in Binfield Heath into a community facility, and refurbishing Warborough and Shillingford Village's Great Memorial Hall. The Council's proposed budget includes plans for another round of capital grant funding in 2026-27. Eligible projects must be located within the district or within 3 miles of its boundary." And the article is accompanied by a colour photograph of the revamp work at the Berrinfield Centre's new community cafe last year.
Public are invited to have say on shape of council borders. The public can have their say on how new councils in Oxfordshire could look. The existing councils are going to be scrapped and replaced with 1, 2 or 3 unitary councils by 2028. This means that all services will be managed by each council rather than being split between a county and district council. The government has launched a consultation on 3 possible proposals for the county. It opened on Thursday and will close on March the 26th. One proposal is to create one council for the whole county, which is being backed by Oxfordshire County Council. Another is to create 2 councils with Oxford, Cherwell and West Oxfordshire joining to form Oxford and Shires Council, and South, Vale and West Berkshire joining to form Ridgeway Council. The final proposal is to create 3 councils with a Greater Oxford comprising of the city and its Greenbelt, with most of Cherwell and West Oxfordshire joining to form Northern Oxfordshire Council, and most of South Vale and West Berkshire forming Ridgeway Council. In a clip posted to Oxford City Council's social media, council leader Susan Brown said, "We support 3 councils because Blackbird Lees in Oxford, Henley-on-Thames and Chipping Norton are very different places. 3 councils would mean local services could be tailored to local needs and give local residents a stronger say over how their council is run and better support our local economies, whether that's medical research, health and education in Oxford, or small businesses, manufacturing, motorsports and agricultural in rural Oxfordshire. 3 councils would also allow us to build the homes that we need in Greater Oxford, which would enable people to live near their friends, families and workplaces, while also protecting rural Oxfordshire from overdevelopment and sprawling towns and villages. The leaders of the rural district councils, Cherwell, West Oxfordshire, South Oxfordshire and Vale of Whitehorse, are backing the 2 council option. The leader of Vale of Whitehorse District Council, Bethia Thomas, said, "The 3 unitary option would be devastating for Oxford, the Greenbelt and the surrounding area. The proposal isn't viable. All of the growth is planned for a heavily constrained Greenbelt, and it won't be long before all the developable land is used up and the city has to knock on its neighbouring council's doors asking for help to deliver housing. It's also disappointing to see that there isn't a credible model included in the 3 unitary proposal for the South and North Councils." The leader of Cherwell District Council, David Hingley, added, "After carefully examining all 3 options, it is clear to me that the 2 unitary model offers the best future for our communities. It delivers stronger services, long-term financial stability, real value for money, and the right balance between scale and local accountability. It creates councils that are big enough to be efficient, but local enough to stay closely connected to the people and businesses they serve. Leader of Oxfordshire County Council, Liz Leffman, said, "One Oxfordshire offers a once-in-a-generation opportunity to build a stronger, fairer and more ambitious future for the county. It is the only proposal that fully meets government criteria with the scale, efficiency and resilience to save the most money and withstand future financial shocks. The stability to protect and improve critical services and the simplicity residents want. We will reduce duplication, protect our critical services, and have the scale to focus and invest in prevention and early help, tackling inequalities and homelessness. By bringing together all the levers of local government into a single resilient authority, we can unlock the full potential of our people and places, drive innovation, and deliver the high-quality services our communities deserve. The government says it intends to make a decision on which option will go forward before their summer recess in July. Respondents can either take part in an online survey or write directly to government with their views." And there are three maps with the three different options.
Boris to treasure archives. Boris Johnson has said he will treasure 236-year-old unearthed archives of his Oxfordshire home. The former Prime Minister lives in Brightwell Manor in Brightwell cum Sotwell near Wallingford with his wife Carrie and their children. Oxfordshire law firm Hedges recently repatriated to its rightful new owner a piece of history. The firm's owner and managing director, Nicola Poole, met with Mr. Johnson to hand over a collection of rare 19th century documents detailing the heritage of his home. Mr. Johnson said, "I shall treasure them." And there's a picture there of Boris and Nicola Poole with the said documents.
Anger, as countryside called, racist. There is fury over claims by a government body that the Oxfordshire countryside is racist. National Landscapes, which oversees areas of outstanding natural beauty, including the Cotswolds, Chilterns and the North Wessex Downs, parts of which lie within Oxfordshire, has said people feel unsafe in the countryside because of their faith or race. The taxpayer-funded organisation said, "From feeling unsafe outdoors because of your faith or race, to being unable to get out in landscapes because of physical disabilities, through to not knowing about these incredible places or how to access them because they are not part of your life and social circle. There are innumerable reasons why people don't spend time in the outdoors, and National Landscapes teams are committed to reducing the barriers to access." The organisation committed to projects to open up the outdoors to ethnic minorities. Previous schemes include a project welcoming children from deprived areas to Northumberland, the Putting Down Roots programme, which encouraged underrepresented communities to the North Downs Way National Trail, and weekly walks for people with dementia. The announcement follows research commissioned by the government that examined practical barriers which may deter certain groups from visiting rural areas. One recommendation suggested dogs be kept under stricter control, citing fears of the animals among some communities. There has been a strong backlash to the report. Liam Walker, head of the Oxfordshire Conservatives, said he didn't recognise the analysis at all. He said, "I've never heard the kinds of comments being attributed to rural communities, and it risks unfairly stereotyping the countryside as unwelcoming or hostile. This feels like another taxpayer-funded focus group exercise designed to justify its own existence rather than responding to a genuine evidenced problem. At a time when public money is tight, I seriously question whether this is a good use of funds, The countryside is for everyone already, and we should be careful not to talk it down in the process. Les Gordon, 62, landlord of the family-run pub, The Leathern Bottle, in Lucknow, on the edge of the Chiltern, said, "The countryside is absolutely not racist. I walk up the hills every day with my Labrador, and there is nothing like that, not at all. Completely wrong. I have never come across it. I know the area very well, and I have never come across anything racist in my 35 years here." And the article is accompanied by a colour photograph of Councillor Liam Walker leaning on a fence with a field of sheep behind him.
There are now three announcements. Barbara Andrews of Wallingford passed away peacefully, aged 88 years, on the 15th of January 2026. She will be greatly missed by all her family and friends. Funeral service on Monday, the 16th of February, at St Mary's Church, Wallingford, at 11 o'clock. Family flowers only, please. Donations, if desired, for Oxford City Farm may be sent care of Chadwick's Funeral Service, 33 Benson Lane, Cromarsh, OX108ED, or made online via barbara-andrews-1937-2026.com. The second one is Leslie Arthur Lane, FCIS, passed away on the 20th of January 2026, aged 89. He will be fondly remembered and greatly missed by his wife of 66 years, Marion, son and daughter, son-in-law, and friends and family. The funeral will be held at South Oxfordshire Crematorium on Wednesday, the 25th of February at 2 o'clock. Family flowers only, donations if desired to RNLI, care of Chadwick's Funeral Service, as previously. And the third one is Mary Robertson, passed away peacefully on the 25th of January 26, aged 93. Much loved mother, grandmother and sister. She will be deeply missed by her family and all who knew her. Funeral service on Wednesday the 11th of February at 11:30 a.m. All Saints Church, Didcot, OX11 7ER. Family flowers only, please. Donations, if desired, in memory of Mary, to Cholsey Day Centre, care of Ridgeway Funeral Service, Hill Farm, Church Lane, Steventon, Abingdon, OX136SW.
How it started, how it's going, and it's an article on Westgate House, Wallingford. At Westgate House in Wallingford, residents are at the heart of everything they do. Run by the Orders of St John Care Trust, OSJCT, the home continues a charitable legacy of the historic Orders of Malta and St John, which share a long tradition of caring for others with love, compassion, respect and inclusivity, values that continue to guide care today. Westgate House officially opened in 2003 on land once belonging to the local grammar school, an area rich in history for the wider Wallingford community. Millington Road, named after former headmistress Mrs. Millington, serves as a reminder of the site's educational past. For some residents, moving to Westgate House felt like coming full circle. Several grew up locally, attended the grammar school, and later returned to the same grounds to be cared for, bringing memories, stories, and a deep personal connection to the home. Westgate House has evolved significantly over the past two decades, transitioning from the former Blue Mountain site. The home reassessed residents' needs and redesigned units to provide modern, person-centred care. Continuous improvement has been a hallmark of the home ever since, with recent refurbishments including a bistro-style area with a coffee machine, creating a welcoming space for residents and visitors alike. Few people know Westgate House better than Rose Ramadani, head of care. One of the biggest changes I've seen over the years has been the introduction of digital technology, she says. Tools like eCare have transformed how we monitor and respond to residents' needs. They also support residents' daily activities, cognitive health, and help them keep connected with their families. The home was the pilot site for the Trust's activities coordinator role, pioneering a structured, meaningful approach to social engagement and well-being. This focus on enriching daily life transformed how residents connect, interact, and stay active, and the success of the role led to its adoption across all OSJCT homes. Community is central to life at Westgate House. The home regularly opens its doors to the wider community, hosting a monthly community coffee morning where residents, families, friends and neighbours come together over tea, coffee and conversation. Intergenerational opportunities remain a highlight, with residents enjoying regular interaction with children from the on-site nursery and local schools. Home manager Daniela Midwinter reflects, "Westgate House is more than a building, it's a community. Seeing our residents happy and engaged is what drives our team every day. From its historic beginnings to its modern technology-enhanced community, Westgate House continues to grow, remaining steadfast in its dedication to compassionate, person-centred care." And there's a photo, well, three photographs, one of the actual house, one of some of the residents in the community area, and one of the staff.
And also from the announcements page, there's a little article called On This Day. And it starts off with 1990, South Africa's black nationalist leader Nelson Mandela was freed from prison after 27 years. Last year, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu threatened to withdraw from the ceasefire in the Gaza Strip and resume the fight against Hamas if the militant group did not go ahead with the next scheduled release of hostages on the following Saturday. On this day, birthdays, Dennis Skinner, Labour politician, 94, Sheryl Crow, singer and songwriter, 64, Jennifer Aniston, actress, 57. Steve McManaman, former footballer, 54. Kelly Rowland, singer, 45. Taylor Leutner, actor, 34. And in history, in 1765, English wig makers petitioned George III for financial relief as the male fashion of wearing wigs came to an end. In 1847, the inventor Thomas Edison was born in Ohio. In 1852, the first flushing lavatory for women opened in Bedford Street, London. In 1929, the 109 acres of the Vatican in Rome was made an independent sovereign state under the Lateran Treaty. In 1940, John Buchan, Scottish novelist who became Lord Tweedsmuir, died. He is best remembered for his creation, Richard Hannay, and the novel, The 39 Steps. And finally, in 1975, Margaret Thatcher became the first woman leader of a British political party, the Conservatives, at the age of 49.
Team of the Week, Bloomfield proud of Hugh's draw at Coventry. Matt Bloomfield has declared he is proud of his Oxford United team as they fought hard to win a point away at Championship League leaders Coventry City. The Yellows had a man sent off late on in the second half of Saturday's match when Will Lankshear picked up a second yellow card with 13 minutes remaining, meaning the Ewes had their backs against the wall for the final minutes. Seven bookings were brandished to United across the whole 90 minutes as they defended resolutely and Coventry wasted their chances. "I think pride of our team," Bloomfield replied when asked for his post-match feelings. "Their defensive resilience, the way they were able to keep fighting against some tough situations. the togetherness, the grit, the determination, all the characteristics that we want to see in our team that make us proud of our team, and I thought we showed them all today. Coming to Coventry, what a club, a fantastic stadium, a top manager, some incredible players for the level. It was always going to be a tough afternoon for us to get a point away from home in any game has got to be respected. But to come here and get a point, we have to be so pleased with that. If you finish above Coventry, you're going to be promoted. They're going to be right up there. So for us to come and show that in a really tough afternoon that was made tougher by several decisions going against us and yellow cards being brandished. I don't think there was a bad tackle in the game. I don't think there was what we'd associate as a bad tackle, but there were yellow cards everywhere. It was a tough one, but the boys dug in. Yellow striker Lancashire was dismissed 20 minutes after entering the field from the bench. He was given a second booking after clattering into his marker when trying to break away after picking up a first yellow card not long earlier. I'm going to sit on the fence and I apologise for that, but I haven't seen the replay back yet, so I probably shouldn't be too committed to a comment until I see that back, the U's boss admitted when asked about the sending off. There were two really quick decisions. If I remember rightly, the first one was really soft and then obviously you're at risk, but I haven't seen the second one back yet. Frank Lampard said Lancashire's sending off was a clear red card. There's a clear red card, second yellow, the Chelsea and England legend declared. Clear, everybody knows. Their bench know because they jumped up like they do when you know it's one and you try and make light of it. And there's a photograph of Michael Hellick and Coventry City's Joel Lambotier, their clash, and there's a large photograph of the junior Benson United under eight black.
And now we've got a few events that are happening. On Friday the 13th of February, a journey through Cholsey's past at 7:30 p.m. at Cholsey Pavilion, Station Road, Cholsey, OX10 9PT. And this is a selection of local stories and appropriate music, something aeronautical, something from World War II, and something about Fairmile Hospital. Music by three pressed men, tickets £5 on the door, and that's cash or card. And on Saturday the 14th of February, there's Beethoven with Ryan Wang on piano at 7 p.m. in Dorchester Abbey. Ryan Wang was BBC Young Musician of the Year in 2024. And Beethoven's Piano Concerto No. 1 of 1798 is a work of youthful energy and classic poise, demonstrating his developing romantic style within the formal structure of the classical period. Symphony No. 7, composed in 1812 at the peak of his powers, is an energetic, rhythmically driven masterpiece, often described as the apotheosis of dance, and tickets are £17.50 to £35 from www.osj.org.uk. On Friday the 20th of February, there's Jazz at the Movies. That's at 7:30 p.m. at the Corn Exchange in Wallingford. And Danny Eilert's band plays live, from Disney to Bond and beyond. Jazz has been a part of all our cinema-going lives. Here's some nine of your favourite movie songs, performed by one of Britain's finest jazz singers and guitarists, Danny Eilert, and an all-star band of his friends. And on the same night is Friday the 20th, there's the Eclectic Jazz Band, and that's at 1700 hours at St. Mary Lamore Church in the Marketplace in Wallingford. And this is a festival launch, and Mr. Hill leads the Wallingford Jazz Band in a sparkling set of jazz favourites. Formerly a music teacher at Wallingford School for over 30 years, Nick is on piano and is joined by Stuart Henderson on trumpet, Joe Carey on sax, Pete Whitehouse on trombone, Howard King double bass, and Mike Goff on drums. And again, on Friday, and this is over 3 days, there's the Winter Jazz and Blue Festival at various venues in Wallingford. And the Wallingford Winter Blues and Jazz Festival promises a weekend to blow the winter blues away and bring warmth, music, and momentum to the town. Events take place across town in care homes, churches, the theatre, pubs, restaurants, and hotels.
Okay, so that concludes our recording and reading of the paper this week. Stay listening following this track for some select articles from the monthly magazines. But from all of us recording the paper this week, we thank you for listening and goodbye.
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 Wallingford Museum will mark this, the 50th anniversary year of Dame Agatha Christie's death at Winterbrook House, with an exhibition highlighting aspects of her later life. With the completion of her husband Max's archaeology in the Middle East, the couple spent much more time in their latter years at home in Cholsey. From the 1950s until the 70s, she and Max were both busy writing. Letters and locally gathered memories reveal some of the difficulties and joys they experienced as older age approached. Love of pantomime and dogs feature among the aches and pains, with new material displayed for the first time. Wallingford Museum looks forward to welcoming visitors from Tuesday, the 3rd of March. Enter the Sobel House raffle before the draw on the 3rd of March, and you could win fantastic prizes while helping local families when they need it most. With tickets just £1, prizes include £1,000 cash, a magical hot air balloon ride, a new laptop, and an overnight stay for two at Molly's Diner. For 50 years, Sobel House has provided compassionate, personalised end-of-life care, from medical support to bereavement counselling and creative therapies. Rising costs make this vital work harder, but every ticket helps make a difference. Enter before 9 a.m. on the 2nd of March, and the website address is sobelhouse.org/raffle. Blues Flash. Attention music fans. Make a date with Wallingford Winter Blues and Jazz between the 20th and the 22nd of February, including Fleur Stevenson. Wallingford Winter Blues and Jazz Festival promises a weekend to blow the winter blues away and bring warmth, music and momentum to the town during what is often the quietest time of year. Winter Blues has grown into a vibrant, community-focused and highly inclusive festival, welcoming everyone from seasoned jazz fans to curious newcomers, families and older residents. Events take place across the town, with performances popping up in care homes, churches, the theatre, pubs, restaurants and hotels. As well as evening gigs, there's a strong daytime and family-friendly programme. Children can get involved with hands-on activities such as samba drumming workshops, while the ever-popular Funky Friday sets the tone. The programme spans a spectrum of jazz and blues styles, from gospel and bebop to Delta blues and Cuban jazz, with much of the lineup drawn from Oxfordshire's rich pool of talented musicians. This year's Saturday headliner is Chris Cobson's Echoes of Africa, led by the renowned Ghanaian guitarist. The project brings together sounds and stories from across the African continent. Once again, the George Hotel joins the lineup of venues, temporarily rechristened Wally Scott's, a nod to Ronnie Scott's Jazz Club. I'm reading from the Benson Bulletin, and this is Guide Dogs. South Oxfordshire Community Group for Guide Dogs. The local fundraising group for guide dogs has been coordinated by local Benson resident Shirley for many years. As a group supported by volunteers from across South Oxfordshire, they have raised much needed funds for guide dog services. It now costs £77,000 to breed, raise and train just one guide dog. Every year, around 1,350 puppies take their first steps towards becoming life-changing guide dogs, helping people with a vision impairment live more independently. The group now needs more help. Could you help organise the group's fundraising activities, planning events and collections, speaking with businesses, raising awareness of guide dog services and inspiring other volunteers? We have several volunteer roles available. They are flexible and you can give as much or as little time as you like. We have a website with further information. As Shirley says, we are a very friendly bunch. I've made some lifelong friends, plus sometimes I get to have cuddles with the amazing dogs. It's good to know that the money we raise as a group is going towards helping someone with sight loss. If you would like to find out more, you can call Claire Russell on 07557 168956, or you could come along to the guide dog event at Benson Library on the 17th of February from 10:30 a.m. until 12:30 to learn about the amazing guide dogs, discover how they support visually impaired people, experience the challenges of a variety of sight problems, create your own name in Braille, try to win a fluffy dog in the tombola, or you can purchase merchandise, or they would like to think you might want to make a donation as well. I'm now going to read from The Bridge. Making best use of technology to help cut crime and catch criminals. And I believe this is written by the Police Commissioner, Matthew Barber. Just before Christmas, Thames Valley Police rolled out a live facial recognition operation in Oxford, aimed as much at explaining the technology to the public as well as catching criminals. The use of live facial recognition technology can bring great benefits to help cut crime and catch criminals. While the use of this technology is widely welcomed by most people, there are understandable concerns by some. I have worked closely with the police to ensure that all the necessary safeguards are put in place to protect privacy, and the only people who should have anything to fear from the use of live facial recognition are criminals seeking to target people and property in our community. The system does not and cannot identify everyone that it sees, but instead is looking for those on a specific watch list. Those who are either wanted by the police or have a warrant issued for them by the courts. Essentially, it's very much like the screen lock that many of us will use on our mobile phones. It recognises the people the police are looking for, but simply doesn't recognise the rest of us. It is important that the police explain the use of this tactic and ensure widespread consent from the public. The use of any technology just provides a tool to the police. It is still the men and women of Thames Valley Police who will use their professional judgment and put themselves in harm's way to protect the public. The effectiveness of these operations will continually be evaluated, alongside other tactics the police use. With more officers in neighbourhood policing roles and overall crime falling, it remains important that the police are able to address the issues that matter most to the public. You can play your part by reporting any crimes or suspicious activity you see in your community on thamesvalley.police.uk or by calling 101. On the first operation in Oxford, 8 arrests were made, several for domestic abuse offences. Dangerous people are being taken off the streets to prevent crime. This is also from the Benson Bulletin, Santa Flight. Chinook spreads festive cheer with Santa Flight. On December the 4th, RAF Benson's 28 AC Squadron welcomed a very special passenger, Santa Claus, for a festive flight aboard a Chinook helicopter. This heartwarming tradition is about giving back to the local community for their incredible support throughout the year. For the first time, Santa swapped his sleigh for a Chinook, soaring over Oxfordshire to spread Christmas cheer ahead of his busiest night. The Santa flight is more than a seasonal spectacle. It's a way to say thank you to local schools and families who donate gifts for children receiving treatment at Oxford Children's Hospital, John Radcliffe. This year, 26 schools and the RAF Benson community came together to donate over 550 gifts, ensuring young patients experience the magic of Christmas. RAF Benson extends its deepest gratitude to these schools for their generosity. A true example of what can be achieved when communities unite in the spirit of giving. The Chinook helicopter, usually tasked with troop transport, resupply and casualty evacuation, played a very different role, delivering festive joy. Operated by the RAF under Joint Aviation Command, the Chinook is a vital asset for UK defence, and 28 AC Squadron at RAF Benson ensures crews are trained for frontline operations. On December the 5th, Santa continued his mission on four wheels, personally delivering the donated gifts to children at Oxford Children's Hospital. Supported by Oxford Hospital's charity, he visited Ronald McDonald House before heading to his grotto at the hospital, where he met families and shared magical moments. Santa even surprised some children with bedside visits, bringing smiles and a few happy tears. Reflecting on the day, Santa said, "The joy on the little ones' faces when I surprise them is what makes Christmas magical for me. Next year, I must remember to take tissues for the parents. They got a little emotional." RAF Benson remains deeply thankful to the local community for their continued support of the station, its personnel, and this special festive tradition. Together, we've shown that the true spirit of Christmas lies in kindness, generosity, and community. We wish all in our local communities a happy new year. So, following on immediately from the article about UAM Cottage, we have the sad case of the Tuckwell girl. This enigmatic sentence was recorded in the diary of Lady Taunton on the 24th of February 1843. Fortunately, the diary was taken to Auckland by her emigrating niece, Blanche, and transcribed in the 1970s by a former UAM Cottage curator, who kindly shared with us many documents relating to the history of the Lush family. The mystery remained on file as to why a society lady would record a sad case of a humble village girl. By coincidence, the answer came a few weeks after Ruth's visit from Bob Allen, a Tuckwell family researcher. Amy was born in 1823, one of eight children of labourer David and Harriet Tuckwell, and had gone away to work. She came home pregnant and very ill, and died 10 days later on February the 19th, 1843, giving birth to a stillborn baby. On 25th of February, the Oxford Chronicle and Reading Gazette gave a report on the inquest. Incredibly, David and Harriet denied knowledge of Amy's pregnancy. This aroused suspicion, as it was conjectured the birth and concealment could not have taken place without their knowledge. Their house and the immediate neighbourhood were strictly searched, and on February the 20th, while Amy was being buried, the body of a female infant was found in a shrubbery, adjoining the residence of Mr. Joseph Franklin, in whose employ the girl's father is. This was New House, now called the White House, in Cat Lane. The Tuckwells were arrested as they left the churchyard. At another inquest, Harriet finally confessed the delivery of a dead baby. She had concealed everything from her neighbours to avoid disgrace, nor had she sought medical aid, but had administered salts in copious doses to Amy. Her husband resolutely persisted in denying all knowledge of the circumstances, but finally cracked when the infant's body and his wife's evidence were shown to him. He burst into tears. "Well, gentlemen, if I must confess, I must. I dug the hole and my wife put the child into it." As the post-mortem proved the child was stillborn, they were dismissed with a severe reprimand from the coroner. The two surgeons agreed that Amy's death was caused by premature confinement and the gross neglect and injudicious treatment of her mother. Both coroner and jury regretted they had no power to commit the Tuckwells, but they were determined to use every effort to bring them to punishment. Whether or not that happened is another mystery. And that was written by Carol Sawbridge.